When she pulls up the code on her laptop, she physically recoils. "Wow," she says, speechless as she scrolls down the file and scrolls and scrolls. "Yeah," says Cranky Dave, laughing. "This is 2,000 lines of code to determine whether we can ship to the order location. A bunch of architects made this framework 15 years ago, predating Phoenix. Even the Teplarb came around and realized this was all a terrible mistake. But the people who wrote that framework are long gone." Maxine keeps scrolling and scrolling, gobsmacked that she can't find any business logic, just boilerplate code, loops iterating through orders, order items, line items, just as dangerously as the middle school girls had done so many months ago. There's a null checking everywhere, as well as type tests, downcasting, coercing, and all sorts of horrible contortions to get at the desired data. Do the enumerated types or polymorphic supertypes without concrete subtypes. There's so many object methods that she can't keep them straight in her head. Get order lines, get item lines, get shipping lines. She opens her mouth, but nothing comes out. "This is incredible," she says at last, with apoplectic horror and disbelief. She closes her eyes, trying to summon some relentless optimism, thinking of the Hoare principle. There are two ways to write code. Write code so simple there are obviously no bugs in it, or write code so complex that there are no obvious bugs in it. "Gentlemen, we are going to clean up all this crap," Maxine says, with a level of confidence that she realizes may be foolhardy. Even Cranky Dave looks cowed. She exhorts, "This should be simple code. All we need to do is retrieve the locations from the order, right? We can do this." They spend 2 hours writing tests around the code to make sure they really understand how it works, and then they start pulling out common operations, putting them where they belong. Maxine modifies the class hierarchy to their best advantage, but adheres to functional programming principles, using modern types and their idiomatic map, reduce, and filter functions, just like the famous Google Map / reduce paper that inspired Shannon's Panther project. By noon, they've reduced the 2,000 lines of code to 500 lines. Cranky Dave grins. "That is amazing, Maxine."
"This is probably the first time in over 5 years that anyone was brave enough to touch this code."
8 years, says the other developer. "This code is beautiful, and I think I found the problem. Here's some code that isn't wrapped in a try-catch block." Looking over his laptop, Maxine immediately knows they found the issue. "Nice work." Now that they've drained the swamp of the muck, the problem is obvious. While they go get lunch, Maxine stays behind, wanting to try an idea out. She opens up a new window on her laptop. She copies the data that the team has been manipulating all morning and starts redoing the code from scratch in Clojure. 45 minutes later, Cranky Dave is back and hands Maxine her sandwich. He asks, "What are you grinning at?" "Oh, just the results of a little experiment," she says. "I rewrote our code in a functional programming language, using its built-in data types and standard library to see if I could make it even simpler, smaller, and get rid of the need for exception handling." "And?" prompts Cranky Dave. She turns her laptop around to show him. "Holy shit," he says, staring at her screen in disbelief. 50 lines of code. Maxine laughs, knowing that they'll be inspired to try to match or exceed her results. Even for her, this was an incredible display of achieving the first ideal of locality and simplicity.
"The work they did this morning will enable parallelized testing and make it blazingly fast,
surely creating huge productivity dividends long in the future, allowing developers to keep moving fast, getting even faster feedback on any errors. It's like the opposite of technical debt. It's like when compound interest works in your favor. If they could make developers a little more productive all the time, it would always pay off in spades." Maxine smiles as she sees Cranky Dave open his laptop, still giddy with excitement over their successes. He says, "Uh-oh." On his screen is the Unikitty CI status page. Maxine looks to see whether the fix that they checked in before lunch passed the automated tests. But instead of getting all green lights, she sees that the tests aren't running at all. There are over 50 jobs in front of them, all waiting to start. "This is bad," Cranky Dave says. The entire Unikitty CI cluster is down. Everyone's builds are stuck. Annoyed, Maxine looks over at his screen. She curses. This is ruining what is supposed to be their shining moment of triumph and glory. He says, the Pound CI Unikitty channel is going nuts. No one can run their tests. Whenever Unikitty goes down, they have a bunch of angry customers, their fellow developers. What better proof that Unikitty is an internal platform that they must manage like a product, not just a project? It's never done if they want to keep their customers happy. They look all over for the Unikitty team. They find Dwayne, Kurt, and two other engineers in the conference room, crowded around Brent's laptop. Good timing. All the dev managers are screaming that their teams can't get their work done, Kurt says, looking up from the huddle. Maxine is surprised at how haggard he looks. He has bags underneath his eyes. Kurt's having a rough couple of weeks, she thinks. We can't afford this distraction right now, of all times. This is what we always wanted, right? Customers, Maxine says with a big smile. You wanted people to value the infrastructure we're creating. Well, your wish has been granted. After all, if they didn't care, they wouldn't even bother complaining. The adoption of CI practices has been astounding, with nearly one-third of all engineering teams using Unikitty in their daily work. But they're having problems scaling it down to keep up with demand. She looks at her watch. It's almost noon. Every developer tended to check in their code before heading out to lunch, which probably caused something in Unikitty to fall over. Unikitty is having more than its share of growing pains, Maxine thinks. Kurt sighs. If you look in the chat room, many of the dev managers are saying that they're tired of our flaky build servers and that they're pulling their teams out of Unikitty. They're going to go back to doing builds the old way. Maxine's smile freezes on her face. You're kidding. Going back to the bad old days like her first days on the Phoenix Project would be intolerable. That wouldn't be a setback. That would be a genuine disaster. What was happening? It felt like all the progress they had made with the Phoenix developers and with the achievements of the Black Friday launch and the Unicorn Project were slipping away. They were slowly being pulled back into the morass, dragging all the engineers that they had liberated and made productive back in with them. It's almost 4:30 when the Unikitty team finally gets things back up, but there are so many builds and tests backed up, it will be almost midnight before all the jobs finish running. I can't believe it was a networking switch failure, Dwayne says. Maxine shakes her head in disbelief. Another Unikitty hardware failure is embarrassing. From the beginning, it had been cobbled together from whatever equipment Kurt and the team were able to scavenge from almost every corner of the organization. They've had disk failures, power failures, and now network hardware problems. She hates seeing highly skilled engineers walking around with screwdrivers, opening up server cases, and mucking about with physical infrastructure. Sure, she has many fond memories of working on hardware, both in her career and with her kids. When she was a young engineer, she had loved opening those huge boxes full of the newest, hottest equipment on the loading dock, and then racking and stacking them. But back then, she also loved rotating the backup tapes. Now this type of work seems so low value, especially when compared to the opportunity cost of the work they should be doing, which is figuring out how to blaze the digital future of Parts Unlimited. Their job was to build code, not muck with the actual hardware that the code runs on. I hate to say it, but I think Unikitty is on her last legs, Maxine says to Dwayne. We can't keep running something this mission critical with hardware that Brent finds under his desk. And it's not just hardware issues. Each build server is still slightly different. Like when my compile job doesn't run on build server number 3, it takes 10 times as long. We're spending too much time keeping it running. We've got to do something about this, soon. No argument from me. We're all just so busy right now, Dwayne says, shrugging his shoulders. Maxine can't argue with that.
As was predicted, there is hell to pay.
Tuesday morning during Kurt's team meeting, Kurt says, Chris not only chewed me out in front of everyone at his staff meeting, but he invited Rick, too. He presented his plan to create a competitive CI service to compete with Unikitty. Rick? Dwayne asks, expressing the complete shock and disbelief that Maxine feels. He wouldn't recognize a CI service if it bit him in the ass. Kurt slumps. Sarah has apparently started shouting from the rooftops that Unikitty is jeopardizing the entire company and that we should be shut down. Silence falls over the entire table. Amazing how people are blaming us for anything bad that happens around here. The toilet broke on the second floor yesterday, and we're being blamed for that too, says Cranky Dave. Kurt's phone buzzes. He picks it up and stares at the screen for several moments. He looks at Maxine. We gotta go. Bill just pulled together a meeting with Maggie. More bad news, I think. Maggie sees Bill look up when his assistant Ellen lets her, Kurt, and Maggie into his office. We've got problems, he says, standing up and picking up his clipboard. We're meeting Steve and Dick in 15 minutes in Building 2. I'll brief you on our walkover. As they walk outside, he says, Sarah convinced Bob and the rest of the board to freeze all expenses effective immediately, and Steve just found out that they're denying the $5 million he was going to allocate to the innovation efforts. Bill shakes his head. That Sarah is something, isn't she? I have learned so much from her. She's an incredible expert in merchandising, but she's never led software projects, Maggie says. She creates high expectations for everybody, which is great, but she definitely has some blind spots when it comes to managing people and teams. She's not exactly a nurturing type. No, I suppose I don't, Bill says, grimacing. I have a really bad feeling about this meeting. When they walk into the grand conference room, Maxine immediately knows something is wrong. Steve and Dick are here, as well as Chris. But surprisingly, so are Kirsten and, very ominously, Laura Beck, the VP of HR. Having the head of HR in a meeting is never a good thing, Maxine thinks. To her surprise, she spots Eric standing at the back of the room, looking at the historical pictures hanging on the wall. He gives her a quick wave. At least Sarah is nowhere to be seen, Maxine thinks. Grab a seat, everyone, Steve says, looking up from a printed spreadsheet, a grim expression on his face. You probably heard that Sarah successfully convinced the board that we shouldn't increase our cost until after we release earnings. Unfortunately, that's not all the bad news, he says. Last night, the board instructed me to reduce costs across the entire company by 3%. Sarah and our new board director, Alan, have convinced everyone that the success of the Black Friday promotions have unlocked huge new efficiencies. Therefore, we don't need as many people. Maxine hears gasps from around the room. She feels like she's going to throw up, or cry, or both. I cannot believe this is happening, Maxine thinks. I feel like I'm partially responsible. After all, I had a lot to do with making the unicorn project so successful and planting the seeds of the innovation effort. And somehow, those successful efforts that she is so proud of are now going to cause a bunch of innocent people to lose their jobs. Damn it, Sarah, she thinks. Sorry, folks, I know this is surprising news given the increased revenue from Unicorn. I really thought we had more time with the board, Steve says. You've probably already done the math, he continues. To hit this goal, we're going to have to reduce headcount across the company by about 150 employees. And to fund the innovation efforts from internal operations, we're going to have to find an additional $5 million of cost to cut or reduce headcount by another 40 people. Maxine hears more gasps around the table as the casualties keep mounting. She can't breathe, and she feels her eyes tearing up. She looks at Laura, the VP of HR. So this is going to be one of those meetings. Now that the reduction targets have been set, everyone will first defend their turf, trying to maintain their slice of the pie. Once the allocations have been agreed to, everyone will come up with a list of names of people to eliminate. Then they'll have to decide whether Sally is more important than Sam or vice versa. Maxine is filled with dread. Looking around the table, she says, "These are real people. People with families who depend on them. These are people who will be walked out the door with all their things. One after another, everyone will watch people leave, dreading that their name will be called next. Wondering when the managers will finally be done piling up the bodies. Only then will Steve's scheduled email go out to the entire company, announcing that the purge is over, including saccharine remarks of optimism and, of course, asking everyone to do more with less." Everyone drops their heads. Suddenly, Maxine doesn't want anything to do with any of this. She wishes things could go back to the way they were, She wishes she had never joined the rebellion. She only wanted to get the builds going, to make developers productive. She had never imagined that it would be the rebellion that would be helping decide who would get to stay and who must leave. If I had known that joining the rebellion would lead to all this, she thinks, looking around, I would have kept my head down, stayed in my lane, not rocked the boat, just like Chris told me to.
I really thought they'd give us until January, Dick says, shaking his head.
The purpose of this meeting is to prepare a plan to submit to the board that takes down the operating expenses by $15 million. And if we want to fund the innovation efforts, we need to take costs down by $20 million. Steve and I have already met with the heads of each business, and we've asked them to put together a plan to cut their part of the $20 million target, he says, which is why you're all in the room. We need you all to come up with a plan to eliminate $2 million from the IT organization. That's about 15 people across all of your groups. Maxine does the math. That's more than 4% of all technologists in the company.
No, this is horrible. We can't fund the innovation effort given all this. It's just not worth letting all those people go, Maxine says. She sees everyone turn toward her.
Some with expressions of hardened weariness, and some with sympathy. As if she were a child who just discovered Santa didn't actually exist. Maxine, around this table, we're all too used to doing layoffs, Bill says. I'm guessing that all of us believe that our most important work today is finding a way to fund the innovation effort. Otherwise, everything you've done and achieved will go to waste. We'll just be choosing a slightly slower death. If we don't invest in doing new things, we'll still end up where we started, outgunned and outmaneuvered in the marketplace. Chris turns to Maxine. Bill is right. It's the right thing to do. Maxine just shakes her head, still aghast at the human toll. Steve looks at Maxine. Yes, protecting the innovation effort is our most important task. If I didn't believe this, I would have just threatened to resign. After all, they can cut costs without me. But this work is so important that we must do everything we can to make sure the innovation group gets its chance. This all makes Maxine feel even worse. But why? Why is this innovation effort so important to you? Maxine finally asks Steve. Steve looks thoughtful for a moment. What Eric said last week was right. As a company, we must show that we have a viable growth thesis. And that we can create value in ways besides just cutting costs. By the book, there's two extremes for how to run companies, which affects how you plan and how the investment community perceives you. On one extreme, you have Alan and Sarah's way of creating value, which is just by cutting costs. You squeeze every bit of margin you can out of the operation. Some companies thrive at this, and some manage to malinger for decades. But most eventually fade and disappear, Steve explains. But when you're in this mode, you're often just playing financial engineering games, Steve says, gesturing at Dick. In order to stem our losses, we've had to do a couple of asset sales to generate cash. But this can be like selling the furniture to pay the mortgage bill. Eventually, you run out of things to sell, and you can no longer fund daily operations, which means more layoffs. On the other end of the spectrum, you can choose to build the company for growth. Like I said, if you're not growing, you're slowly dying. The Unicorn Project has proven to all of us that we can actually grow by creating new offerings that customers want, by taking market share away from our competitors, by doing things that great companies do, Steve says, with a thin smile. And when we grow revenue, we eventually grow profits too. And we earn the ability to innovate and place more bets in the marketplace, which accelerates growth and ensures our relevance in the future. Investors reward growth, he says. Already our stock price is up, and we haven't even reported earnings yet. Analysts are starting to raise their price targets. This means Wall Street is rewarding us with higher multiple on revenue. A couple of months ago, we were valued at less than 1x trailing revenue, which is almost an insult because they're expecting us to shrink. When we announce the results of this quarter, hopefully, they'll start valuing us as they would any healthy retailer. And in time, they may value us much higher as someone who is defining and leading and maybe even disrupting our market. Bill is absolutely right, Maxine, he says. The easier thing to do is to just do what the board says. But the right thing to do is ensure that the innovation program has its shot. It sucks, but as leaders, there should be no doubt that cutting deeper is the right thing to do, because it creates a potential path to long-term growth.
Maxine still feels sick as the managers start to negotiate which departments will eliminate 18 positions.
They debate whether they will eliminate a few experienced engineers or, for the same price, a larger number of junior engineers. Ask the managers or individual contributors. Eliminate employees or contractors. When she can't take it anymore, Maxine excuses herself to take a walk, just to get out of the room. When she gets back a half hour later, she sees that Chris has agreed to RIF, reductions in force, 2 dev and 5 QA positions, most likely underperforming engineers and several managers. Bill must RIF 7 positions, targeting the help desk, server, and network administration positions, as well as a manager. Maxine hopes that Derek will survive this, not to mention her old MRP team. Surprisingly, Kirsten has put on the table 7 project managers, noting that the rebellion has changed the way teams work. "Long term, we don't want to manage our dependencies, we want to eliminate them," she says. "That's the system of work and the company architecture we need to create, which means fewer project managers. Maxine has shown repeatedly how this can be done, and we have so much further to go." On the one hand, Maxine is impressed by the professionalism being displayed by everyone in the room. But hearing some of the names being proposed for the RIF and being held up as the reason to let go of more of Kirsten's team, Maxine feels like she's going to throw up again. "You'll probably have to cut even deeper than you think," Eric says from across the table, speaking for the first time since the meeting started. Maxine had nearly forgotten he was there. "Oh, great," Bill says. "Last time we met, I mentioned Sensei Jeffrey Moore's 3 horizons, but I didn't have time to explain his concept of core versus context, which are what the 4 zones are about," Eric says. "Sensei Moore observed that many businesses understand the 3 horizons, but are still unable to properly invest in the next generation of innovation. In other words, they underinvest in core because they are being controlled by context. Cores are the central competencies of the organization. These are things that customers are willing to pay for and what investors reward," he says. "Context is everything else. It's the cafeterias, shuttles between buildings, and the thousands of things companies must do to operate. They're often mission-critical, such as HR, payroll, and email. But our customers do not pay us for the great payroll services we provide to our employees. Not properly managing context is what Sensei Moore called the killing ground of great companies. Companies who become too burdened by context are unable to properly invest in core. There is a strategy for transforming a company, but it also takes ruthless focus and tenacity." Eric looks at Bill and Steve. "You know that technology must become a core competency of this company, and indeed, that the future of Parts Unlimited depends on it. But how much of the $80 million of your technology spending is core, actively building competitive advantage, and how much of it is context, which is important and maybe even mission critical, but still needs to be standardized, managed down, and maybe even outsourced entirely?" Bill bristles, turning red. Up until now, he always appeared remarkably stoic and reserved, but apparently Eric had touched a nerve. "You're talking about outsourcing, after all we've been through? Eric, haven't we already agreed that outsourcing IT has caused many of the problems we're currently cleaning up?" "Hardly," Eric scoffs. "You've all proven that you can jeopardize the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd ideals plenty without outsourcing. Instead, think of the 5th ideal, of being truly customer-centric instead of being silo-centric. As Sensei Moore asks of the applications and services that you manage, which of them are customers willing to pay you for? Which ones truly enhance competitive advantage, and which can you rely on vendors for? 100 years ago, most large factories had a CPO, a chief power officer, who ran the electricity generation processes. It was one of the most important roles in manufacturing because no electricity, no production. It was a core process," he says. "But that role has disappeared entirely. Electricity has become infrastructure that you buy from a utility company. It is interchangeable, and you choose suppliers primarily on price. There is rarely a competitive advantage to generating your own power. It is now merely context, no longer core. You don't want to be the organization that has a large staff providing internal power generation. As Sensei Clay Christensen once stated, one keeps what is not good enough and outsources what is more than good enough, he says. Why did you choose to outsource your cafeteria point-of-sale system? Bill looks thoughtful, scratching his chin. I had my team work with John, the CISO, to figure out which applications stored PII or credit card data. That's like toxic waste. We shouldn't waste time or energy protecting it. We get rid of it. We looked for those applications, and where we could, we retired them. And if we couldn't, we looked for an external vendor who could run it for us as a service. Precisely, Eric says, standing up. I challenge you and the technology team to think deeply about the fifth ideal and identify areas of context that you can unload, freeing yourself from decades of technical debt, things that have been shackling you for years, or maybe even decades. Imagine what you can get done without all those things dragging you down. Even though it may be more painful in the short term, you will find some unexpected and critical dividends long term. Steve, lucky for you, according to Sensei Moore, the person best suited to manage context is someone just like Bill and Maxine, Eric says. This is never easy. You need someone who truly understands the business, someone hard-nosed, who can drive standardization across the company, who truly has the best interests of the entire organization at heart, and who knows what technology can and can't do. Imagine a world where you can make decades of technical debt disappear, he says. Where you rid yourself of bad automation built up on top of bad business processes. Imagine what it could feel like to deliberately and carefully choose what to leave behind and where you could spend your time and energy instead. Dick knows that simplicity enables effectiveness and that complexity conspires against it. How much of getting business done here is impeded by your internal systems and processes? This makes Maxine pause. The notion of simplifying the business and technical landscape of the company is breathtaking. She loves working on complex business problems, but it would be so much better and easier if they weren't obstructed by the decades of senseless complexity and accumulated neglect. Lastly, to everyone else, especially Steve, he continues, think carefully about how each and every position you eliminate might disrupt flow. Especially when you don't have locality in decision-making, as embodied by the first ideal. For instance, what happens when you get rid of managers when you already have situations like the square happening all the time? Those middle managers are your interface between strategy and execution, he says. They are your prioritizers and your traffic cops. We all have this ideal of small teams working independently, but who manages the teams of teams? It's your middle managers. Some call them derisively the frozen middle. But you'll find that properly developing this layer of people is critical to execute strategy. I wish you the best of luck, Eric says, turning to leave. And hang in there, Maxine. If you choose wisely, better days are most assuredly ahead of you, however dismal it may appear now. Everyone remains silent on the walk back to Building 5. Finally, Maxine says to Bill, "You don't talk much, do you?" Sometimes, he says with a tight-lipped smile. What do you think of that last meeting? She asks, the question that's likely on everyone's mind. Bill stops to look at Maxine for a moment. It sucked ass. On the one hand, it looks so much like the same drill that everyone in ops deals with all the time. Do more with less, outsource this, outsource that. In the past, this has led to some incredibly unwise decisions. And people like us are left cleaning up the mess afterward for years. And when everyone's realized that we crapped the bed, we often have to bring everything back in-house. There's nothing fun about that. But this time it could be different, he says, resuming his fast-paced walk. Steve and Eric are absolutely right. We must find a way to protect the innovation efforts. This is the key to our long-term future. For the first time in my career, I think we can change the way we manage technology and do it right, with the support of the highest levels of the company. But this is not going to be easy, he says. I like what Eric said about context and core. There are services we should get out of the business of operating. One of the places I'm thinking about is my old mid-range group. We've created the Galapagos Islands of Technologies, which served us well for decades. But we've drifted so far from where the entire industry has gone that we haven't been able to benefit from all the things the industry vendors have created.
Maybe it's time to build a bridge back to the mainland, or maybe vacate the island completely. He continues, I wonder if we can reskill everyone on my old team and find new roles for them without driving up operating expenses. There's going to be a bunch of new positions in the innovation effort. I want them to have a shot at it. They have so much domain expertise and institutional knowledge. It'd be a huge loss if we lost them. Same with Kirsten's project managers. Bill continues to think in silence as he walks, which is fine because Maxine is feeling even more troubled than before. Has her old MRP group become inhabitants of their own Galapagos Islands, too?
I think this all sucks, Kurt says, brooding.
For the rest of the day and into the next, Maxine and Kurt tag along as Bill, Chris, Kirsten, and their teams struggle to come up with a plan to deliver the needed headcount reductions. Although Steve told Dick that his job is to help both sides of value and growth, Dick assigns two of his direct reports, the director of business operations and the corporate controller, to help them. Maxine is very impressed by them. They are two hard-nosed business people who seem to know every nook and cranny of the company, but it's still very grim work. Maxine is often tempted to take a walk or skip these meetings entirely because she sometimes feels overwhelmed at the human toll that all of this has put into motion. But she knows that this is important, even critical, to get right, and she absolutely wants a say in what happens. At first, each department manager divided their people into three categories: critical, desired, and riff. Of course, only a few people ended up on the third list. Seeing the three names, it was clear that managers were using this as an opportunity to get rid of people that should have been eased out long ago. But that wasn't nearly enough. So Chris and Bill started turning the screws on each manager, scrutinizing and comparing people on their manager's desired lists. After nearly an hour of this exhausting wrangling, Maxine is reminded of something Eric said. Wait, Eric cautioned us on the need to examine things from the perspective of flow. Maxine says, we can't do this by department or by some popularity contest. If we take random people out of a value stream, we could do as much damage as what the bean counters did in Dwayne's story of the three manufacturing plant network switches. And in our world, where we currently don't have sufficient locality in our decision-making, she says, it's actually our managers who are figuring out how to expedite the most important work. Eric called them the traffic cops and prioritizers. Both Bill and Wes stare at her. Bill says, good idea. Let's put this aside for a moment and instead focus on trying to distinguish core versus context. What are the broad areas of technology that we can eliminate? Maxine is acutely aware that the ultimate goal of this exercise is to reduce operational expense. They need to reduce the number of people on payroll. Obviously, unhappy at being asked to figure out how to dismantle the empire that he's helped build over the last decade, Wes mutters, this feels so wrong. Not so long ago, these were things we were arguing we needed. But even he acknowledges that there is an urgent and important business imperative to do this. When he sees Bill put up his old mid-range group on the list of candidate technologies to eliminate, he groans. Holy crap. I'm sorry, Bill. That's rough, he says, staring at the whiteboard. Sure, I've made fun of them for being frozen in time like Encino Man, but they're good people. And I sure haven't had any reason to complain about their work. Thanks, Wes, Bill acknowledges. But honestly, there are SaaS vendors out there who we can pay to do much of what we've built. And that will give us five people. And we'd eliminate a whole technology stack, along with all the software licenses and maintenance contracts associated with it. That's another $100,000 of annual spend, which is another half of a head right there. Wes sits in silence. Well, if you put it that way, I'd pay anyone in duffel bags of unmarked bills to get rid of our help desk system. Of course, we'll have to get a replacement service, but I'd rather have a vendor managing it anyway. And our email servers and Lotus Notes, which we still have pockets of, believe it or not, because a couple managers complained loudly. I think we finally have the clout to override their objections. Combined, the workload of managing all those things is easily three people, Wes says. Of those, two I'd want to keep around. All I'd want is the opportunity to take a sledgehammer to some of those servers before we haul them out. Maxine stares at Wes and Bill. They're not exactly being magnanimous, but they aren't being cold-hearted bastards either. In fact,
She much prefers this approach to comparing lists of names between departments. Inspired, Maxine gathers up her courage and says, "Maybe we should take a look at the Manufacturing Resource Planning Group, too." When Chris looks at her in surprise, she says, "There are certain pieces that are absolutely critical for competitive advantage, such as the scheduling module that we're changing from build to forecast to build to order to support on-demand manufacturing. But the rest of it could be moved onto a commercial package. I'd keep 5 developers on the team to finish the transition, but that would free up 10 developers and QA people, and maybe 2 other ops people." She feels ill. The people she's reduced to numbers are the wonderful people who wished her well when she was exiled. This was the system she helped build and maintain for nearly 6 years. Even Eric said it was an architectural marvel. She quickly adds, "These are some of the best engineers in the company. I personally vouch for each and every one of them. If they could work on projects like Unicorn or in the innovation areas, their contribution to the company would be much higher than on the MRP system." "You're right," Chris says, looking proudly at Maxine. She feels relieved to finally suggest this, which is something she's been dreading all day. Bill adds Maxine's old MRP group to the whiteboard, joining mid-range financials, cafeteria POS, help desk, email, and Lotus Notes on the list. Together, they identify 18 positions that they can eliminate. The software services to replace them would cost $500,000 annually. Bill adds another column. If the innovation effort is fully funded at $5 million, that could potentially create 33 technology positions in core. We could potentially hire all these people back, as Maxine pointed out, doing work that is far more valuable. So let's keep pushing. Come on. What else might we want to unshackle ourselves from so we can reallocate more people to core? What are things running in our data centers that customers will never pay us for? We've already outsourced payroll. What other back office functions might we want to consider? We have 3 ERP systems, Maxine offers. It's a pain to have to integrate with all of them. In fact, all 3 of them are owned by 1 company now. Maybe now's the time to bite the bullet. Wes nods. If we switched to 1, that would free up another 2 or 3 ops people to do something else. I like where this is going, Bill says. How about our HR systems and sales commissioning tools and compensation planning and our time carding systems and plans? At the mention of the time carding systems, which were at the epicenter of the payroll failure that led to her exile, Maxine mutters, "Good riddance." "Yeah, and our desktop backup systems," Wes adds. "Maybe even our telephone systems and PBXs. We're a manufacturer and retailer, not a phone company." Wes's face lights up. "And there's 2 data centers that we should have shut down years ago. Between them and what's in them, they probably cost us $1 million annually to run. And if we actually got rid of them, that's another 4 people. Oh, and those damned kumquat servers. Let's get rid of them once and for all. That's another $100K in maintenance costs." Looking at the growing list of ignoble contacts on the whiteboard, Maxine doesn't feel dread. Instead, she feels inspired, thinking about how jettisoning these things will liberate the company from things that slow it down and present the opportunity for engineers to work in areas of far higher value. There is 1 more thing bothering her, though. "Our Unikitty CI cluster is on its last legs," Maxine says. "It's important context, but still context. We have our best people working on Unikitty. It's made a world of difference elevating developer productivity, but we should find a commercially supported SaaS vendor and get our best people working on things that we can't find commercial vendors for. Come on, Kurt. How much time have Dwayne and Brent spent propping Unikitty up?" "Damn," Kurt says, but after a moment says, "But yeah, add it to the list." Dick's finance team presents their tabulations. Everyone stares. They've identified nearly $4 million of expenses that could be reduced with 26 positions being eliminated. But if they opened up 33 positions in innovations, they could hire almost all of them back, if they were willing to learn new things. Maxine smiles. Maxine is amazed by how quickly Bill is able to get on Stephen Dick's calendar, impressed that he has that type of working relationship with the CEO. They are presenting to both of them by the end of the day. In contrast, there are times when it takes weeks for Maxine to get on Chris's calendar. She briefly wonders if the problem is her or Chris.
When Bill presents their plan, Steve and Dick take notes, asking questions, and eventually nod in approval. Steve especially liked how the team identified areas to eliminate by value stream while maintaining flow. But when Bill talks about their desire to move talented engineers and retrain them so they could contribute to the innovation efforts, Steve becomes visibly excited. During my manufacturing days in the 1990s, I had to oversee a massive reskilling of the workforce, he says. We made huge investments to make sure every worker could survive and thrive in a new era where everyone was being paid not just to use their hands, but also their heads. It was one of the most fulfilling and rewarding things I've ever done. We must do the same with the technology workforce. And I don't mean just putting up posters on the wall, he says. I mean we really invest in our people. Maybe we create a Parts Unlimited University or some other long-term training where we create the next generation of leaders and engineers we need for the long-term survival of the company. We pay them to get the skills they need. Steve looks excited and alive in a way that Maxine has never seen before. Even Dick looks excited. I need your help on this one already, Steve, Bill says. Take my old mid-range team that I used to manage only 4 months ago before you put me in this role. Through no fault of theirs, they're in a business process that is context, not core. We need to do right by all our people and help make sure that we prepare those people to have long and productive careers. They have valuable knowledge that we'd be idiots to let walk out the door. You bet, Steve says. Maxine breathes a sigh of relief. Maybe this whole thing can be a force for good after all, Maxine thinks, even though it was Sarah who lit the fuse. Dick has been taking notes and occasionally tapping on his calculator. We need $15 million in cost reductions. With the numbers you provided, we're nearly there, Dick says, looking at his staff, who nod in return. In manufacturing, we'll be shutting down production of our lowest margin category of products. This affects 50 workers, of which 15 will be filling currently open positions. The head of supplier management plans on saving another $2 million by reducing our number of suppliers, he says. We're using this to negotiate higher discounts and reduce logistics overhead, and it shouldn't create much hardship at all. On the retailer front, we'll be shutting down 10 of the lowest performing stores, which will save us about $3 million. Dick continues. And the rest will be gained through early retirement and some elimination of positions. Dick pauses to look at the spreadsheet. I think this is a pretty good plan. The biggest risk I see is the operational risk from transitioning to these new systems. They're context, but they're mission critical. We've never changed this many business processes, let alone all at the same time. And I'm sure we're going to have a bunch of very unhappy people who will come up with a bunch of reasons why we can't. Just so you know, some of those objections are undoubtedly correct. This is just a working list created by us, a bunch of spreadsheet jockeys, Bill says. At our level, we don't really know what the implications of shutting these systems down are and what it takes to transition. We need time to work with our teams to figure out what's even possible and come up with a realistic timeline. That's a good plan, Bill. Dick nods. Steve, you need to find a way to buy him some time. Steve looks at the spreadsheet on the screen. Maybe we ask the board that instead of the 3% cut they asked for, we deliver a plan to cut 2% in January before the quarterly earnings announcement and get to 4% by the end of the next year. That should satisfy them. Not bad, Dick says with a smile. That will make Alan and his voting bloc very happy. Okay, I'll work on socializing this with the board, Steve says. Once we get approval, I'd like to announce this to the company and be as open about it as possible, so people can prepare for it. To Dick, he adds with a small smile, Sorry, Dick, we may need a couple more quarters of that financial engineering to keep the numbers going in the right way. Maxine is so relieved that her worst fears about the cost reduction plan haven't come true. However, she doesn't feel carefree. Instead, her acute fears of the worst happening are replaced with a dull, constant gnawing sense of unease. For the rest of the day, she feels utterly spent and exhausted. Her left eyelid keeps twitching and her stomach constantly hurts. Sometimes she can't quite look people in the eye. A quick Google search confirms that this is probably all due to prolonged stress. All these types of people management issues are why she always veered clear of management roles. That night, she forces herself to relax, having a couple of glasses of wine and watching the Red Wedding episode of Game of Thrones with her husband, eager to be distracted from anything related to work. She's stunned by the ruthless cruelty and senseless violence of the massacre at the end, and she and Jake laugh about how lucky they are that modern work environments don't involve wholesale slaughter, even though Sarah had certainly given it her best shot. Chapter 18, Thursday, December 18th. When she wakes up on Thursday morning, she feels well-rested and excited about the day. Part of it is from having gotten a full night of dreamless sleep, but it's also because today is when the finalists for the innovation ideas will be pitching the entire Innovation Council. As promised, Bill picked 50 of the most respected people from across the company, making them responsible for choosing the first three innovation ideas to be staffed and explored. Those three winning submitters would each have a team hand-selected by Maxine, and they'd have 90 days to explore the viability of the idea, investigating market risk, technical risk, and business model risk, and hopefully achieving some fantastic agreed-upon business outcomes. This would be the Horizon 3 work that they were fighting so hard to protect. Maxine was astonished that back when Steve announced to the entire company that anyone could submit an idea, within a week they had hundreds of submissions. Being on the committee, Maxine read all of them and was inspired by their creativity and thoughtfulness. Almost all of them attempted to address real problems that their customers had, and many of them displayed ingenious ways that Parts Unlimited could help. She marveled at how strong people's intrinsic motives were to explore these problems. The committee deliberated and picked the top 30 proposals, and today, all of them are pitching the entire Innovation Council in the big auditorium where they normally held the town halls. Each of the pitching teams had been able to rehearse with some of the committee members during the week, getting any desired coaching and guidance. Maxine loved how committee members were so generous with their time, especially right before the holidays. For the people pitching, these interactions would help create useful networks and would likely help advance their careers. Maxine walks to her desk, eager to get the most urgent work done so she can go to the auditorium and help with the innovation pitch preparations. As she sits down, she sees a text message from Cranky Dave. Holy crap, check your email. When she pulls up her email and sees the subject line, she breaks out in a cold sweat, whispering, "Oh no." From Sarah Moulton, SVP Retail Operations, to all IT employees, CC Company Executives. Date, 8:05 a.m., December 18th. Subject, Changes to Personnel and Responsibilities. Effective immediately, Maggie Lee, Senior Director of Retail Product Marketing, has been reassigned to assist with an urgent inventory audit at our retail stores. Because of the time criticality of these issues, she is relieved of all duties, including any Innovation Council work. Please direct all those communications and decisions to me. Furthermore, Kurt Resnick, QA Manager, is suspended of all responsibilities for reasons I cannot responsibly disclose. Please direct all Innovation Council-related issues to Rick Willis, QA Manager, and all other issues to Chris Allers, VP R&D. Thank you, Sarah. Shocked, Maxine stares at the email. She cannot quite fully comprehend the enormity of what just happened. Sarah has effectively decapitated the Horizon 3 effort. To defend Horizon 1 and her quest for value, she has ensured that the Innovation Council work dies before it even gets started. Oddly, Maxine feels neither angry nor sad. She feels numb and suspects it's because all her mental fuses have been blown from Sarah's incredibly bold move. With some disbelief, she realizes that Sarah has engineered her own Red Wedding at Parts Unlimited. She picks up her phone and frantically tries to call Kurt and Maggie, but neither of them answer their phones. She texts them, asking them what's going on. She gets no response from either of them. She stares off into space for a long time, trying to think of what she can do. She looks up and notices that people are gathering around her desk. Cranky Dave, Dwayne, Brent, Shannon, Adam, Perna, Ellen. In a frantic voice, Cranky Dave asks, "What the hell is going on? Does anyone even know?" No one has any idea. Nobody can reach Kurt or Maggie or Kirsten or Chris or Bill for that matter.
The junior officers and bridge crew have all disappeared, leaving the redshirts completely on their own. For the third time, Maxine sends another text message to Kurt. What's going on? Where are you? Everyone is freaking the hell out.
Is the rebellion over? Brent asks the question that's on everyone's mind. Are we all going to be shut down?
Get a grip, Shannon says, rolling her eyes. But Maxine can tell that she's shaken too, because no one actually knows what's going on. Maxine tries to be the mature adult in the room, calming everyone's fears, but deep down she's rattled to the core. Maxine looks at Brent. Maybe this grand adventure really is over. Maybe Bill is next on the chopping block. How high up does a corporate coup like this go? Maybe Steve is gone too. Has Sarah just really won the war?
Maxine pictures Sarah sitting in the captain's chair on the bridge of the Starship Enterprise, grinning triumphantly with an all-new bridge crew, having completed her purge of the old guard. Maybe she'll have all the heads of her vanquished foes mounted on posts to deter the next would-be rebels.
Would she reach all the way down into the engine room and purge all the red shirts who were associated with Kurt and Maggie? Normally, she would have dismissed this idea as absurd. Bridge crew don't care about red shirts, right?
But the way Sarah has conspired to undermine all their efforts makes her rethink that idea.
It's not difficult to imagine her going through the entire red shirt roster, dividing them into naughty and nice lists, with the naughty people being beamed into exile to the planet SETI Alpha 5, like Khan and his followers had been 15 years before he took revenge on Captain Kirk. Not Sarah. She'd probably arrest them all right now, and just beam them into the middle of a star to prevent any possibility of future wrath, Maxine thinks. Say what you want about Sarah, but she can definitely think ahead. Maxine looks at her watch.
There's only 45 minutes until the pitches are scheduled to start in the auditorium.
Maggie is missing in action and won't be able to lead the session as planned, and she's guessing that Steve will be a no-show too. Who's going to save Horizon 3? She looks around. In that moment, she realizes that it's all up to her now. She picks up her desk phone and calls Steve's extension on the landline, getting his assistant, Stacy.
Hi, I'm Maxine Chambers. I was in the meetings with Steve and Dick regarding the Innovation Council, along with Kurt and Maggie. We're all a little freaked out at the message about Kurt and Maggie being suspended. Steve was scheduled to present at the Innovation Pitches at 9 o'clock. Will he still be able to make it?
Hi, Maxine, she hears from the other end of the line.
Amazing timing. I was just about to call you. Steve has a message for you. He says, take charge of the Innovation Pitch meeting. Good luck. He will be there if he can, but he'll likely only be able to stay for a couple of minutes.
Steve's assistant asks for her cell phone number so that Steve or Dick can text her later today. After Maxine gives it to her, she says, hang in there, Maxine. We're all rooting for you. Maxine hangs up the phone and stares at her desk for the briefest moment, girding herself for what she must do.
Come on, everyone, she says. We need to get to the Innovation Pitch meeting.
But Maggie and Kurt have been rounded up by Sarah. Who is going to lead it?
Shannon asks.
We are, Maxine says, gathering up her things.
In the front row of the big auditorium, the focused excitement and nervousness of all the teams getting ready to present is palpable. If anyone dropped out because they saw Sarah's email, Maxine doesn't notice. Maxine climbs up on the stage looking for the people who are running the operation. She finds the person who seems to be managing the AV and asks for a microphone so that she can address the room at 9. That's in 3 minutes. Brent hands her the printed schedule of the teams presenting their proposals and then tells the stage manager to start lining people up backstage. Maxine thanks Brent, who grins back.
Good luck, Maxine. Tell us if you need anything.
Maxine looks into the audience and sees all the committee members chosen to judge the proposals sitting in the front row. They'll be listening to each of the teams give their 10-minute pitch. Behind them are hundreds of people who have come to watch the teams pitch their ideas. Maggie has taken extraordinary care to mitigate the HIPPO effect, or highest-paid person's opinion, referring to people's unhealthy tendency to only care what the highest-level decision-maker thought. To counter this, Maggie instructed the entire Innovation Council to listen to each pitch, ask any questions, but keep their votes and ratings secret. She looks around for Steve, but can't find him. She looks at her watch. It's time.
She waves at the stage manager and motions that she's ready to go. The stage manager says something in her headset and then motions counting down from 3, 2.
"Hi, my name is Maxine Chambers," she says into the microphone, squinting into the bright lights.
Maggie Lee was supposed to lead this meeting, but as you may have read in the email, she's been put on an urgent mission to do an inventory audit." She hears laughter in the crowd, which surprises her. She hadn't intended that to be funny.
"And Steve was supposed to say some words about the proud history of the company and how we must help keep our customers' cars running. He was also going to talk about how important he thinks fostering innovation within the company is, but he's unable to join us at the moment. We've assembled an amazing group of some of the most respected people in the company to judge these pitches. We had hundreds of proposals, and I read every one of them. They're all amazing, and it was so difficult to choose just 30 of them. But we did, and they will all present to you today," she says, hoping her voice isn't cracking and that her nervousness isn't showing. She wishes she had worn a jacket to hide the sweat pouring from her body. "Each team will get 10 minutes, and then we'll have 5 minutes for Q&A. At the end of the day, the council will deliberate, and Steve will announce the 3 winners at the next town hall. My team and I will have the privilege of working with each of these teams to test the viability of their ideas," she says with a big smile. She thinks about the events of this morning, and her eyes start welling up with tears. She says, voice cracking, "We have made a bunch of sacrifices to make this happen. So I'm grateful to all of you for putting so much work into your pitches. And I promise you that we'll do our best to make them a reality." She smiles and feels teary-eyed as she hears everyone clap and cheer. She looks at the stage manager, who smiles and gives her a big thumbs up. Maxine looks at the sheet of paper in front of her, shaking visibly in her hands, and calls the first team up on the stage. As she goes backstage, she sees Brent appear next to her, saying, "Holy crap, Maxine, that was awesome. I'm so glad everyone is going to be able to pitch their ideas, even after all that, you know?" Maxine smiles back, giving Brent a quick hug, thanking him for his help. She turns her attention to the team pitching. Maxine is delighted by what she hears. One store manager presents her idea of helping rideshare drivers, such as Uber or Lyft drivers, with their unique needs. Another proposes a concierge service for common maintenance tasks. But the first idea that generates buzz throughout the auditorium is a rating system for garages and service stations, which immediately gets the nickname Yelp for Garages. The idea is to have Parts Unlimited customers share their experience about service stations with other customers. Another proposal that excites Maxine comes after the morning break. A senior sales manager presents an idea to create a 4-hour delivery service to their service station customers. This would enable those stations to offer more repair services, knowing that needed parts could be quickly delivered as needed. A competitive startup had recently emerged offering 4-hour delivery, and the Parts Unlimited business unit that sold directly to service stations already cut their revenue forecasts for next year by 10% because of them.
This team is convinced that Parts Unlimited can take on this competitor and win,
and that it will improve their relationships with their most important service station customers. When its ringleader says, "Given all our capabilities, I think we can wipe this startup completely off the map," the auditorium erupts in cheers. Some of the other presentations are also very good, but by mid-afternoon, Maxine sees the pitch that she falls in love with, only partly because it is being pitched by Brent, Shannon, Dwayne, and Wes. She can't resist cheering for them as they take the stage. She is so proud of them. Their idea is to sell an engine sensor and create a huge array of offerings around it. Initially, it will focus on earlier detection of car problems while they are small and before they can snowball into big expensive problems like oil changes and engine wear. Stores could provide these repair services for discounted rates to their customers because the work could be scheduled during slow periods. Many months ago, Wes saw that one of the items recommended for him on the app, powered by the Unicorn Project, was an engine sensor that they recently started selling in their stores. It had been flying off the shelves. It was a surprisingly neat device. It attached to the onboard diagnostic port 2, ODB2, that every car has these days, required by the landmark 1994 California Air Resources Board Act. This standard data connector enables monitoring of engine characteristics,
including, most famously, emissions levels.
Maxine is surprised to learn that even new electric cars like the Tesla have ODB2 ports, even though they don't have an internal combustion engine. The idea is to either OEM or resell one of these sensors and then build a world-class software ecosystem around it to help with everything from on-site diagnostics, advisory services to customers, and better preventative maintenance. They also describe ideas such as working with insurance companies to help reduce premiums and making apps to help parents track their kids' driving habits. This was so compelling to Maxine that she immediately bought the sensor during the pitch on her phone. Maxine is always terrified of her kids driving too fast. At the end of the pitch, despite her desire to be impartial, Maxine leaps to her feet and cheers. In her mind, it's ideas like this that can take Parts Unlimited to exciting, new, and vibrant places. There are other pitches that catch her attention too, but she knows who she is going to vote for. At the end of the day, Maxine takes the stage again and says, "Thank you all so much for presenting all these amazing ideas. We'll be collecting all the ballots at the end of the day, and Steve will be announcing the winner at the January Town Hall. See you then." She waves at everyone and hands the stage manager back her microphone. She's exhausted. Her legs are shaking, her back hurts from standing, and she prays that she doesn't sting from all her nervous sweating and standing under the hot lights. As she rejoins her fellow Rebellion members, she thinks about the day. Maxine feels relieved and energized about the innovation pitches. As wrenching as the reorganization and workforce changes will be, if they enable exciting things like this to happen, it will be worth it. And better yet, she will always have the satisfaction of having helped make it a reality. But now, they need to figure out what happened to Kurt and Maggie, and for that matter, the rest of the bridge crew who have gone missing, and whether the innovation effort will happen at all. It's after 5, so they all decide to meet at the dockside as usual. As people arrive at the bar, Maxine keeps asking if anyone has any updates or news, or even new rumors to share. But no one has heard anything. There has been complete radio silence, aside from Sarah's email. There have been no further official company communications or announcements. Maxine says to everyone, "Look, whatever happens, even if Maggie and Kurt have been fired,